Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of January. All things political, which you always hear Monday at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Today we have a lot to talk about. Huge bonuses for Wall Street executives. And this is the season for those bonuses. What about the rest of us? Harry Reid's comments, were they racist? And what about those comments surfacing during a time when he has to maneuver health care reform as it enters its finish line? Interesting interview with the person who was really in charge of having Sarah Palin be on John McCain's ticket and how ill-prepared she was for her role as vice president. We'll talk about President Obama's concentration on all the good he has done and Maureen Dowd's comments that the president has missed the moment to be president. And we'll talk much more about health care reform getting to the finish line. Those are a few of the areas we'll discuss this hour, plus whatever our guest wants to bring up and whatever you'd like to bring up this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor George Waller, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. We met him when we did our remote from Appleton in August, wasn't it? Back in August. We welcome your phone calls for Professor Waller and welcome him to the show. Hi, Professor Waller.
Good morning, Kathleen. A pleasure to be with you again.
Yes, very nice to have you here. Let's start with Harry Reid's comments. I don't know what he was thinking when he made those comments, but a lot of questions here. The Republicans are saying he should resign. Is Trent Lott resigned? He also has to maneuver this very intricate piece of health care reform legislation at this point. Democrats are rallying around him. What do you make of those comments?
Well, it's interesting. I tell you, it couldn't come at a worse time
right.
for Harry Reid. Not only does he face those problems, but he's got his own issues with his reelection effort in Nevada. He's already appears to be in some kind of trouble in that reelection effort. But I think on the larger question of whether the comments were racist or not, it certainly has been a topic for many Republicans to push. You saw that yesterday morning on the talk shows with the release of that new book that it appears that from their perspective that the Democrats and liberals have a double standard, obviously holding Trent Lott to a standard when he made his comments about Strom Thurmond. So it certainly isn't something that bodes well for Harry Reid, and it certainly does inject another element of controversy and disarray, if you will, into the Democratic Party. Whether they were racist or not, I mean, clearly they were ill-advised comments, and I'm sure that Harry Reid, as we've seen, has made an apology to the president, which the president has accepted. But whether they were racist or not, they were certainly ill-advised comments, and he certainly should not have made them.
And do the Republicans have a point when they say if that had been Mitch McConnell, everybody would have been out to get him to resign?
I do think they have a point. I do think it does appear at least to represent a kind of a double standard. The difference, of course, was, you know, and you could make this argument, and I'm sure Harry Reid would make this argument, that his comments were off the record and weren't delivered in a public setting. Although the authors of the book certainly say that Harry Reid was fully aware that those interviews and those comments were a matter of the record. So in any case, I do believe it does have that kind of smell factor that many people look at, is to see that, you know, it just represents a kind of real problem politically for Harry Reid and the Democrats to have this kind of thing come out at the very moment, as you mentioned earlier, that they're trying to engineer and maneuver health care through the Senate and the House.
That book is making a lot of waves. I don't know how long it'll last, but over the weekend it certainly did. The interesting interview on Sarah Palin on 60 Minutes last night. I don't know if you had a chance to see that. But it was really something. The guy who was, you know, running the McCain campaign saying that she just had to be brought up to speed on virtually every topic before the country.
Right. And I think that, you know, that's something I think a lot of people felt when during the course of the campaign, particularly after the Katie Couric interview and other interviews, the Charlie Gibson interview, that it didn't appear as though she was really up to snuff on a lot of those issues. And here we get sort of confirmation of what many people felt was the case by the very people who were in the know in the McCain campaign. It does bring up, you know, an interesting issue that, you know, I also in that book was the comment supposedly made by Dick Cheney that McCain's choice of Sarah Palin was a reckless one. Liz Cheney yesterday, of course, on one of the Sunday morning talk shows, denied that and said that it wasn't an accurate reflection of what her father had said. But it does appear that, you know, there is some confirmation now from within the McCain campaign that that Sarah Palin clearly wasn't up to snuff on those issues. And it does cause one to wonder why, if that were the case, would John McCain choose someone like Sarah Palin if people in his own campaign had reservations about her qualifications?
Mm-hmm. Well, it also makes one wonder why her book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, you know, she does have a constituency.
Yes, she does.
She certainly does have a constituency. There are people out there who really do feel very strongly that Sarah Palin represents a kind of fresh approach to American politics, and they are very willing to forgive her of any of those things. Many of those who take that view with respect to Sarah Palin also feel that she was done wrong by the McCain campaign and was sort of not treated fairly by the campaign and was kind of kept under wraps and wasn't allowed to do her own thing. But, of course, you know, one would expect that a vice presidential candidate would not be taking the lead in directing a campaign.
Right. I had never seen this before, but when she asked, "Can I call you Joe?" he was talking about the fact that she always referred to him as Old Biden.
That's right.
I never knew that. And then you saw a little clip where she did refer to him as Old Biden. So they said, well, let's get this straight off the bat.
Exactly. I mean, clearly they knew, I think, going into those debates that they had to make sure she didn't make those kinds of,
right,
you know, blatant errors. And so I think that was the safest thing for her to do. And obviously they counseled her very strongly to make sure she could call him Joe so she wouldn't make that kind of mistake. It would have been a glaring error in those debates, and it wouldn't have served her or the candidacy of John McCain very well.
Let's talk about Wall Street for a moment. This is the time when people are going to be getting huge bonuses. The Times had an infuriating, I'm sure, story to many Americans when they talked about the pay six, seven, even eight-figure sums for some chief executives and top producers. We've given them a lot of money. We're not making money. Unemployment is high. I'm amazed that people aren't just outraged by this story.
Well, you know, I think people are. I think people are really angry about it, and I think they're concerned that something is broken in both our political and economic systems when this kind of thing can continue to happen. You know, in many respects, I think that people feel sort of hopeless about how to affect change. I mean, clearly the president has indicated, and many other political leaders have indicated, that it would be inappropriate for Wall Street bankers to you know, allow those kinds of bonuses. Of course, the argument from the bankers is that it's all part of doing business. It's the way you keep good people. It's the way you can recover the financial institutions. But again, from the perspective of most Americans who are struggling through what is undoubtedly the deepest recession since the Great Depression, this just doesn't sit well at all. It's very infuriating for people to have to watch that when they themselves are having to make these kinds of sacrifices.
So how should Washington, the administration, and Congress be dealing with that?
Well, you know, from my perspective, somebody's got to step forward and say we simply are not going to allow this, that either the Treasury Secretary Geithner, the Obama administration, or Congress ought to do something very, very strong in terms of passing regulations that might, in effect, put a damper on those kinds of bonuses. The problem is when you do that, you're going to get the argument that if you do that across the board, it's really going to represent a real damper on business effectiveness and a kind of rolling economy. I mean, that's the kind of struggle that takes place here. And politically, when you've got the situation you have, it would appear that it's going to be something that seems to get caught up again in the kind of partisan perspectives that one has on these kinds of issues. And that's why I think Americans also feel that the political process is incapable of dealing with some of these economic messes. And that obviously creates a real kind of downturn in consumer confidence and a kind of sense that something's just really wrong with both the economic and political processes in the country.
It's hard to believe that they, in good conscience, can do this again.
Yeah, it is astonishing. I mean, one wonders where their sense of ethics and morality are when they know full well that people are struggling. And these are the same big banks, as you mentioned, that we bailed out with taxpayer money. I mean, in effect, you know, they've begun to pay some of that back, but in effect, they're thumbing their nose at what the American taxpayer has been able to do to rescue them from the brink of financial collapse, and yet they're continuing these practices that so infuriate Americans. You add this on to, you know, what they're doing with credit cards in anticipation of, you know, the credit card reform bill. You know, the idea that you can be charged a fee for non-activity on your card, and all of these ways to get more money out of long-suffering American people who are having to put up with this. It is infuriating.
Professor George Waller is our guest for All Things Political, Assistant Professor, Political Science, University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. Our first caller is Cliff from Appleton. Hi, Cliff.
Hi, good morning. I just find myself having consternation with all this irritation at Mr. Reed. As a light-skinned African-American myself with a doctorate degree, I found Harry Reid's comments to actually be quite astute into broader racial attitudes in America. There's a research article called Looking Deathworthy, where they looked at the skin tone of inmates on death row, and they found, or in murder trials, and they found that darker-skinned people with more African-looking features were more likely to be put to death. I think that we're deluding ourselves if we don't think Mr. Obama would have had a harder time getting elected if he'd be talking Ubonics all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What Harry Reid said was on point, and I think people just want to make a mess out of everything that happens, like the sky is falling, and I call it a Chicken Little phenomenon that I'm seeing going on. Reid was right on.
Professor Waller.
I think, Cliff, you make some very, very excellent points, and I think it is very true that one of the things we've got to get our heads around in this country is to recognize that race is still an issue in this country. In politically, socially, economically, it is still an issue. And I think it is absolutely the case that we need to have an open and honest sort of discussion about the implications of race and what race means and how it continues to have an important place in our politics, our social life, and our economic life. It may well be that Harry Reid's comments were on point. The fact of the matter is, however, that when you have this kind of an opening for Republicans to point out what they see as a kind of double standard, politically it's going to play well for Republicans. There is, I think, this idea that we need to get somehow beyond color, which I think is, of course, something we ought not to do. We ought to talk more openly and honestly about what race means in our society and how it affects our political, social, and economic life.
So two questions for you, Cliff. You don't see that as a racist statement, and B, you think somebody who was very black would have a hard time being elected president?
I think with the broader population, yes. You know, I mean, you look at Clarence Thomas, he was appointed. You know, he didn't run for that office, but I think by and large, America in 2010 still has a lot of prejudicial attitudes where, you know, if you're darker, you're more likely to be put to death. You know, this is a research article called Looking Deathworthy that took into account skin tone. So I encourage people to look up that article.
Yeah. There's a lot of research in political science research on the images of candidates, and we find exactly that kind of a result as well, that darker-skinned African-Americans are seen as less trustworthy by many Americans. We see this in a number of crime studies where people are sort of exposed to stories and then photographs of supposed criminals, and it's always they're advocating a harsher punishment for the darker-skinned Latinos, Native Americans, African Americans. And so race is definitely a factor in our society, and we need to have a much more open and honest discussion about it.
And I'd also like to say, if we think back, you know, Barbara Jordan was dark, but she was one of the most astute speakers, in Congress, in my memory.
Yeah, eloquent and
to
very articulate.
The attitude that's out there, you know, skin color does not make you less wise.
That's right.
Thank you very much for the call. She was marvelous. I love that woman. And it's not just true here. I remember hearing a story on NPR some months ago in India where the number of ads on television and radio and all of the newspapers for skin lightener, it's just huge. It's a huge business in India. We should look into this for a story. It'd be a really good show, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Cliff, for your call. All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. We have tons of phone calls, but we have one line open, 800-486-8655. I want to ask our guest to respond to part of Maureen Dowd's column yesterday that the president is so sure of himself and his actions that he fails to see that he misses the moment to be president. We'll talk about that and get Professor Waller's response to that and also take many more of your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll go to the skies and talk about the top 10 stories of 2009, according to the editors of Astronomy Magazine, which is published right here in the Milwaukee area. So that'll be fun. Two more of your phone calls. We go to Alan next from West Milwaukee. Hi, Alan.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, and thank the professor for his candid comments. I have two rather candid comments. The first deals with the race issue, and, you know, the media ignores the fact that Obama is half white, and that's alienating. He is light-skinned, but he also is culturally white, and I think that's a huge issue for white people who feel alienated because he's always portrayed as being black when, in fact, he's half white.
Mm-hmm.
And you never hear him described as being half white. So that's a very alienating issue for white people to have this man portrayed as being black when he's not. And that's one issue, one comment. The second comment has to do with the outrage about the bailouts and how execs are paying themselves bonuses and continuing with credit default swaps and other risky investments. The American public, we have no way to express our outrage. We can't go out there with pitchforks and torches anymore. We'll be thrown in jail. And the only thing that you can, you know, when you look at other countries, people are out in the streets. What's the channel in this country has to be financial. You know, and I have taken money out of the American system. I put it in Canadian banks. I have put all my money in an IRA if I have to file bankruptcy. And, you know, the only thing you can do is take your money out of the system. And if everybody stopped paying their credit cards, stopped paying their mortgages, and, you know, took their money out of the system, maybe Congress would listen and listen to the American public instead of to the credit card companies and the banks and everybody else.
Professor Waller.
Well, as to the first comment about Barack Obama's race, I mean, it is a fact that his mother was a white woman. I think, you know, it's interesting how race does these things. We heard Rod Blagojevich of Illinois, the disgraced former governor of that state, declare yesterday that he was actually blacker than Barack Obama because of his modest upbringing and his circumstances, and that Barack Obama was in effect someone who, as you mentioned, was culturally white. I don't know what to say about that except to say that this whole idea that the issue of race would be alienating means that we really do have to have an open discussion about just exactly what race means and why it continues to be such a tremendous struggle in this country and internationally, as Kathleen mentioned before. With respect to the other comment about what Americans can do by way of responding to these egregious bonuses given by Wall Street banks, you're right. I mean, if there was a kind of a financial revolution where Americans simply decided not to continue to make their credit card payments, decided to do other things that would deny banks their revenues, I mean, you would certainly have a kind of real crisis. in the American economy, which might indeed collapse the financial institutions. And I don't know if people are willing and ready to go down that road, because it would obviously mean a significant lengthening of real economic hardship. Perhaps we've gotten to that point. I don't know how we impress upon our elected officials the anger that Americans feel about what's taking place. I think it's going to be visited on incumbent politicians of all stripes unless something takes place to stop this kind of activity.
Well, this movement to move your money from those big banks to credit unions into smaller banks that Huffington Post has started is an interesting one. It doesn't have a huge following yet, but there are people who are doing just that.
Yeah, I think that is the beginning of what the caller mentioned about Americans beginning to think about how to take steps to combat what they see as these kind of, you know, these unethical, egregious practices of big financial institutions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Alan, for your call. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. I'd like to talk about an ongoing issue of rule enforcement and couch it in terms of death notices, term insurance rules, and taxes. Now, term insurance protects us from some of the bad effects of premature deaths, but the premature deaths, we can tell from the death notices, continue to come, and they may come from violent killings or drunk drivers or first or secondhand smoke or toxic chemicals inflicted upon us by irresponsible companies. And the tendency is for the Republicans and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party to oppose taxes to pay for enforcement of rules. But rule enforcement, like term insurance policies, help protect us, and so it's incumbent upon us to continue to ask for protection through rule enforcement by our public servants.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. I think you're right on the target here by noting that conservative Republicans and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, as you call it, who are well-financed in their reelection campaigns, are certainly pressured by those institutions not to enact legislation to actually enforce those rules. But, you know, I think, again, it's a matter of whether people are aware of and understand the complexities of what the caller brings up here. And I think unless and until there's an awareness and understanding of those kinds of things, it isn't something that politicians are necessarily going to have to deal with, because they so rely on the kinds of contributions they get from the interests that are opposed to that kind of activity.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about terror. Maureen Dowd had an interesting column yesterday. She usually does. A couple things I'd like for you to respond to. She mentions Russ Feingold. She spoke with Russ Feingold, who said that he's been pointing out since 2002 that we need to focus on Yemen. It's the ancestral home of Osama bin Laden. And what we're dealing with here is an international network. We have to start thinking about it that way rather than as a country-by-country eradication process. And then she goes on to say that the president, even though he takes on these issues and studies them very thoroughly, she says he's so sure of himself and his actions that he fails to see that he misses the moment to be president, to be the strong father who protects the home from invaders. What do you think of both Feingold's comments and her description of the president?
Well, you know, I think Russ Feingold is right. We are dealing with an international network. The Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have sort of franchised out the whole sort of terrorist network, and we're seeing that they're so adept at being able to use different arenas, whether it's Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia, from which to launch these kinds of terrorist attacks. So I think Russ Feingold is very much right about that. That our focus on a country by country eradication process is not the way in which to combat what is obviously a well connected kind of franchised international network of terror. With respect to Obama, I mean, Maureen Dowd makes an interesting point. You know, she talks about the Spock in Barack Obama, you know, a reference obviously to Spock, Dr. Spock of Star Trek, the kind of always in control of emotions mm-hmm. and mental processes that gives President Obama the sense that, you know, things have to be analyzed from a very analytical kind of professorial point of view, and that from
Maureen Dowd's perspective, that misses the opportunity to connect with people on a really emotional and visceral level, something that other presidents have been very good at being able to do. Ronald Reagan was perhaps a master in being able to connect emotionally with the American public. And I think, Democrats often have been more likely to think through things in terms of analysis and a careful, rational approach. And I think often they fail to understand that what really connects people and what can really connect them to people is that really understanding of how people feel emotionally. I think the reticence from Barack Obama to use the terms of the war on terror, to understand how this really does affect people emotionally, is something that I think maybe Maureen Dowd has put her finger on. We'll see what the president will do about what Russ Feingold suggests and whether he'll take a new approach in terms of connecting with the people on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. Ronald Reagan did that. He was expert at doing that.
Yeah.
The comparison has been made with Jimmy Carter here, that Jimmy Carter was considered to be a man of great intellect, as Obama is as well, but failed to have that connection.
Right, exactly. Ronald Reagan was an actor, and he knew how to make those kinds of connections. Barack Obama was a law professor,
right.
And so I think their backgrounds kind of present some interesting insights into their presidential styles.
Sharon is next. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi.
Way back several callers ago, I think you said it. What can Congress do? Here in northern Wisconsin, it feels like they're in a different country. We're not being represented. They're representing the party. And I think that they need to go home during recesses and get to know their people and how their people are living and have to live. And then maybe they could represent us. It showed up in the health care bill, and it's showing up in this bank, these bailouts. I feel completely disenfranchised. Absolutely. And I think that this is a strange-looking democracy to someone like me.
What issues do you want addressed that you feel are not being addressed, Sharon?
Well, the economy, I guess I feel it almost completely. I just don't feel like, especially in the health care, it was all the Republicans this and the Democrats that, and it really wasn't very much about what the people want or need. And I didn't feel like our needs were being represented in the debates. We get hung up on this latest issue with the race. Yes, race runs rampant, especially in the rural areas. People are scared to death of people with different colors because they don't know them. And those are kinds of things that we locally have to work on. But when I try to vote every single election and I go and vote for a representative, I hope that person will be that, a representative. I don't feel that now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been voting a long time. I just turned 70 yesterday.
Happy birthday.
I have strong feelings. I'm a retired university administrator. I listen to news. I know what's going on, and I don't feel like I'm a part of this. This is a whole separate world out there.
I think you're really onto something here, and it is borne out by the way the whole healthcare debate took place. What do you think, Professor Waller?
You know, I think the caller certainly does reflect what a lot of people are expressing. And this is why I said earlier that there's this sense that the political system is broken. In many ways, I think it really points out the importance of people getting involved and getting engaged. And by that, I mean not simply showing up at meetings, town hall meetings, where representatives are and screaming and yelling. I think it really does require that people become much more knowledgeable about what actually is involved in the legislative process, about what kinds of things are included in the legislation. One of the difficulties, I think, is that we for elected officials is that we don't often have a great deal of understanding of just exactly what it is that people want. We have people who express sort of some kinds of views and then backtrack on them. You know, it's part of American politics that people are often angry about things, but they don't have a way to offer constructive solutions about what to do to resolve those things. And so the work of really offering those solutions is left to our elected representatives, and people are sort of disengaged from understanding what's involved and what needs to be done in order to do it. So my counsel would be that people should get involved. They should show up. They should learn as much as they can, and they should confront their elected officials with what they know about these important issues.
Let's go to an email. Senator Reid, if he is forced out, this is from Craig from Madison, or does not win re-election, which Democrat would likely replace him as majority leader?
Wow, interesting. I think Dick Durbin is probably
really
in line for that. You know, he's the number two man in the Senate, and he or perhaps Chuck Schumer of New York, but my money would be on Dick Durbin to take over that role.
Sharon, thank you very much for your call. Interesting comments. We go next to Keith from Milwaukee. Hi, Keith.
Hello. How you doing this morning?
Fine. How are you, Keith?
Doing good.
Good.
I just had a quick comment about the relative anger that the American people seem to have. And I would submit that I think it should be at a much higher level than it is. It seems like people are frustrated and angry, but to me, it seems like the wholesale takeover of politics by big business, big money, should, you know, at this point, it almost feels like there should be pitchforks and torches, you know, because it's clear that the American people no longer really have much power. And I understand your guest, you know, people do need to get involved, but they are just woefully outnumbered by big business, big money, the influence that they have. A single person can go and, you know, get involved, but they still do not have the power that, you know, lobbyists have with their multi-million dollar lobbying efforts. I mean, if you look at the health care bill and such. And I think until that fact is addressed very strenuously, you know, we're going to continue to have the president and Congress fear big business rather than the people.
Professor Waller.
Yeah, well, I what we're hearing this morning is something that we've become more and more aware of, is the sense of frustration that the American people have about the political and economic systems in this country. I think, you know, the caller mentions the idea that people ought to, you know, get really involved and get angry. The problem is people fear that because they don't know if these things collapse, what will they be replaced with? The idea that the economy is broken or the political system is broken forces people to confront a reality of what will be in place if economic and political systems collapse. Will we enter a time of real economic and political chaos? And it's very difficult, I think, sometimes for people to think that, what can I do to take steps that can confront, as the caller says, the corporate powers that seem to be in place in ties with the politicians? And there is that sense of frustration. I think, as I said before, people need to be very much more cognizant of what it takes to be involved, and that includes a real understanding of the complexities of the issues that are faced by elected officials and by the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a much more sort of involved and knowledgeable public, we can start to begin to turn the corner on what we've been seeing occurring politically and economically.
We're getting down to the wire now on health care reform, Professor Waller. A couple questions. Is Harry Reid going to face difficulties because of this latest comment, or at least brought to light comment, in navigating this with the House? And number two is, are there other members of Congress who have kind of fallen by the wayside now in terms of reform, or are we likely to see the Senate bill? When's it going to happen? Take it all on.
Well, yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Obviously, they're working diligently now to try to resolve those two bills, the Senate and House bill. My prediction is that they will work out a compromise conference report. that will probably reflect more of what the Senate has included than what was included in the House bill. I think the House version of the so-called public option, I think, has been jettisoned. I think there's a real understanding that that can't, that simply cannot pass in the Senate and will have difficulty even in the House. So I think we're likely to see, with respect to that, more along the lines of what the Senate had included with the state-run exchanges. In terms of the other major issue that differentiates the House and Senate bills on one of the financing mechanisms, the House bill had included a tax on high-income individuals, and the Senate bill has included a tax on the so-called Cadillac health plans. Both of those face opposition from certain quarters, but I think you're probably going to find that that's going to be the real sort of bone of contention between the two. My sense is that they'll reach some kind of compromise to sort of finance on the basis of both a tax on the highest Cadillac plans and a higher tax on wealthy individuals in order to partly finance this health care bill. So I think there will be a resolution. I think it'll go to the House and Senate. I think it will pass in both the House and Senate. I think Democrats politically need to accomplish this, or it will be seen as a complete collapse and failure, such as occurred in the Clinton administration, and we may see then a repeat of 1994 in the elections in 2010.
Hmm. Another email, Dave from Downington, Pennsylvania writes, "My wife and I stopped using our credit cards, pay only in cash. We never carried a balance, but we don't want to subsidize banks in any way, including allowing them to earn fees from the businesses where we use our credit card. Is there a website for more information?" I don't know. We're going to do a show on this later in the week on how to thwart banks. I'm not sure if you know one.
I don't, other than what the Huffington Post has sort of begun.
Yeah, and we would direct you there, but we will be on this issue later in the week. We go to Tyrone next from Appleton. Hi, Tyrone.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, my question was regarding how much of the Willie Lynch effect is taking place in today's society, especially what's going on with Obama right now, saying that, you know, he speaks elegant, you know, compared to other black people that are just as intelligent but just speak with what I call an accent. You know, it might be Ebonics or whatever, I just call it accent. How much of that is having an effect on this?
Well, as I said, I do believe that race continues to be a major important issue in our society, and I think we need to have a much more frank and open discussion about what race means and how it does have an impact on our social, political, and economic life.
And yet you can't dismiss the fact that we elected Barack Obama to be president. That was a big thing in this country.
It was indeed. It was indeed. And I think what people were looking for was the idea that change from what people saw as, you know, just an untenable situation in the United States was what we were hoping for. The problem is when you try to begin to implement change and you try to get into the specifics of doing it, it becomes much more complicated. I do agree with you. I think the fact that we elected our first black president is an important milestone, but it does not mean that race as an issue is over in this country.
I
think a lot of people felt that that would be the sort of marker that would say we no longer need to talk about it. We're beyond it. We are not beyond it. It continues to be a sort of defining, if you will, struggle in American life.
Yes. Thanks, Tyrone, for your call. More calls in a moment. It's All Things Political this hour, always Monday at 9, and we have a lot on our table this morning. Our guest is Professor George Waller, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is up and running today. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. You know, I grabbed the phone when the professor said, you know, our political system is broken. And, you know, we're being told by one of the parties that it's broken. We're being told by one of the parties that the government can't do anything. They specifically bring up, you know, how the post office is a joke, and that party wants us to believe that we need 60 votes for a democracy because they abuse the filibuster. But this so-called liberal media never brings up the word filibuster. And that party brought us to the cliff. And, you know, a lot of these guys that are running that party were the nudies, you know, back in the 90s. And remember, when they got in power, they shut down the government. And that kind of backfired on them back then. But they've been working at this for a while. And now they think maybe, I think that they think maybe it's time. You know, if they almost had us over the cliff, and if they would have got a guy in, they would have been cutting taxes, which would not have created any jobs, and they would have been cutting Social Security, they'd be cutting Medicare and Medicaid, they'd be cutting poor people's assistance and elderly people's assistance, and they'd be cutting heating assistance, and they'd be taking away from all of the poor people and people that need help, and they'd be giving everything to the corporations.
Professor Waller.
Well, you know, I think it's true from my perspective. I think I agree with the caller that the filibuster in the United States Senate has been used and abused too often, and I think by both parties. I do think, however, that, you know, most Americans don't understand what a filibuster is. They don't understand what a cloture vote motion is to cut off a filibuster. They don't understand the processes by which the Senate operates. They have very little understanding about what the steps are in the legislative process. And these are all things that I think have a real impact on sort of a misunderstanding of the way in which our system works. I think people need to know those things so they have a much more a greater familiarity with how the system operates. In terms of the system being broken, I'm not referring to the specifics of, you know, filibusters or cloture motions or the like. I'm thinking that people are feeling that, as one of the previous callers mentioned, they don't feel that the system represents their interests anymore, that somehow these issues have been sort of co-opted by large corporate interests, by the political parties who tend to use in their political rhetoric characterizations of things in terms of partisan conflict, what benefits Democrats, what benefits Republicans. And I think what people are looking for is a system and a process that solves human problems. And I don't think we're seeing a lot of that actually being delivered in the way in which our system currently operates. That's what frustrates people. That's what I think people are looking for. And I'm not sure what the answer is, except, as I suggested, that people need to become far more understanding and knowledgeable about how to get involved, about what the complexities of these important policy issues are, and express their knowledge and their understanding to their elected officials. Knowledge is power, and elected officials respond to power. And I think if we were much more intentional about doing that and encouraging that kind of civic engagement, we might see some different results.
Let's go back to Sarah Palin for a moment, although not Sarah Palin. There was an interesting article over the weekend about the governor of Florida once considered a shoo-in for the Senate and now being challenged quite significantly by what was described as Tea Party Republicans.
Yeah.
Where is that movement going? Is he in trouble? Will others who are considered more moderate Republicans? I guess it's part of the picture that they're showing is the hug with President Obama. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I think there's a real sort of struggle within the Republican Party between the sort of teabagger element of the party and the more moderate kind of Republican. I mean, I watched an interview yesterday with Arnold Schwarzenegger on Meet the Press, and it would seem to me that a Republican candidate like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's not among the sort of naysayers in the Republican Party, but is in fact expressed support for some of the things that Barack Obama is trying to do, wouldn't stand a chance in a Republican primary anymore.
those Tea Partiers, as you've referred to them, are very, very involved, very committed, very likely to turn out to vote, especially in primaries where candidates are chosen. And I think that represents a real struggle for the Republican Party in terms of how they identify themselves, whether they identify very strongly with the activist Tea Party wing of the party or whether they think more in terms of what we can do to solve human problems. And I think Democrats face that as well sometimes with their progressive or more liberal elements. And in many ways, it pushes that partisan divide, particularly when it comes to those important primary elections where candidates are selected.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Dave. We go to, let's go to Ken from Madison. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. A little more to be said about Harry Reid. I agree with what the caller himself as a light-skinned African-American earlier, but a couple of more points. It sounded like the professor backtracked a little bit talking to that caller from saying that the failure to dump Harry Reid is a double standard to saying it gives Republicans an opening to talk about double standard. Well, they don't need an opening. Of course, Republicans are going to say that. I'd like to know what he actually thinks, his own opinion. I would point out that I certainly had conversations during the election about how Barack Obama's biracial background and mainstream speech patterns played into the dynamics. I'd be really surprised if either of you didn't. I'd like to hear whether you did or not. The word nigger, say, but hardly pejorative. It's been added to the new census forms exactly because some older African-Americans prefer that term and were confused or put off by the alternatives. So to make a big deal about that one word carries no weight at all. I'd really ask some clarifications on those points.
Okay, thanks very much, Ken.
What I meant to say, he's right. I mean, in terms of calling me on what he appears to see as a sort of a backup or a backtracking. I think that Harry Reid's comments were certainly ill-advised in light of how they were likely to be played out politically. I don't deny the fact that as the caller suggests, one of the things that made Barack Obama such an attractive candidate was his articulate elegant speaking style. And I think that really did sit well for his candidacy. I think it was also, to some extent, refreshing for a lot of the American people to feel that maybe we were beyond race, that we could actually elect an articulate black man. And my sense is here that we really need, as I said before, to have this conversation, this open conversation about what race means. I agree. Barack Obama is an articulate, attractive, black candidate, biracial candidate, and I do think that there is a difference between, for example, what Harry Reid said about Barack Obama and what Trent Lott said about Strom Thurmond. I mean, Trent Lott's comments were that America would have been better off had the segregationist Strom Thurmond been elected president of the United States. I think that's a little different level of racist comment, if you will. But at least in terms of how it was going to play politically, Republicans were going to step all over that and indicate that it was, from their point of view, a double standard, which I think is an easy way for many people to sort of buy into that idea that race is something that we should be beyond, when it isn't. It's something we need to confront much more intentionally on an almost daily basis.
And to me, and I made mention of this frequently, the fact that one of the appealing things I think to a lot of people about Obama was that just his very existence was beyond race in terms of how his mother married someone who was from Africa at a time where I'm sure there were some comments made that, and his grandparents being from Kansas of a whole different generation, and they were dealing with race as well. But it's this child of the world thing about him, the Asia connection, the Africa connection, the Hawaii, that you can't say that he's one thing. He's kind of everything, which I think was appealing.
Yeah, I think you're right on there, Kathleen.
Let's go to Marianne from Marshfield. Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm thinking, I know this is tough, but I think we need to revisit the campaign finance reform. And I know I probably would lose, but I would watch really carefully to see how it went and how it was voted. and I would apply that information. That would be part of my information for the next election. I know with large corporations influencing votes and so on, I think that's such a major thing.
Oh, we've been talking about it so long, too, haven't we, Professor Waller?
Yeah, you know, we have, and here's one of the real difficulties. People often express support for the idea of substantive campaign finance reform. And one of the proposals that's often advanced is the idea that you take the corporate money out. You have a system of publicly financed campaigns. But if you do that, what you're essentially going to have to sell to the American public is that taxpayer money is going to be used to finance political campaigns. And as soon as we get to the specifics of what that reform might entail, something like that, people are up in arms. I don't want my tax money to fund campaigns of these politicians. So we get to this point where we say we want something, and then when we get to the specifics of it, we all back off on what we say we want.
Right. Thanks very much for the call. Well, this was a fun hour. We were just took on a lot of great issues, a lot of interaction with the audience. It was good. Thanks, yeah. Professor Waller.
You bet. I enjoyed it again, Kathleen.
Great. Thanks. We'll talk to you again. Professor George Waller, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. Not that we're avoiding political discussions the rest of the week, because, of course, we talk about those issues all the time, but we always reserve Mondays at 9 for a discussion of what's happened over the weekend in terms of the political talk shows, and take a look at all that's on the political plate during this week. So if you are a political junkie, this is your hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing on-air production here in Milwaukee today. Thanks also, everybody, for all of your lively and informed calls. News is coming up, and we'll return with a second hour of conversation for this Monday. This is the Ideas Network.